Hello everyone! This is season 1, episode 5 of The Meridian. As always, we're recording at Lund Observatory and we'll be posting this episode for you on the 22nd of October. Crossing our local meridian in this episode, we have Joanna Lewis, a biochemist and science communicator working in public engagements with science. In each episode, we'll also pick one astronomical object to explore in more detail, and this week we'll be talking about SN1572. Also known as 3C10. What is that? Well, more about that later.
The Meridian.
Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. How are you?
Oh, I'm quite good, actually. It's been the Lund University Future Week this week.
Oh.
Which is Framtidsveckan with the theme breakthroughs.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's been this week with a lot of researchers giving lectures.
Okay.
Well, speaking of, what do you think about the future?
Look, it could be better. I guess it could be worse, too.
You're not quite optimistic?
I'd like to think that I am, but, you know, there's something that's been on my mind a bit lately that I've been reading up on. Have you heard of Starlink?
Oh, yes. The Elon Musk satellites?
Yeah. That's the big plan to put thousands of satellites into space.
How many are there now?
There's about 1,700 of them.
Wow, okay, yeah.
Yeah, but the plan is to have about 12,000, so...
Yeah, it's a lot of satellites.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe we should enlighten people why we think this is a problem.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not just an astronomer's problem, I think, which is the biggest issue. Like, a lot of astronomers are getting upset about it, which is fair enough, but... What I'm really worried about personally is the space junk that's going to come from this.
Yeah, of course, like space debris and...
Yeah, basically, like you're putting thousands of pieces of metal into space.
Yeah.
And we have actually got documented evidence that satellites do collide with each other. And when they do, they create huge debris fields.
Yeah.
And this can actually pose a serious risk to both people, like on the International Space Station and other satellites.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, there's astronauts up in there. And also you can get these sort of domino effects, right? If something clashes into something, then you have like a cascade effect and everything sort of explodes.
Yeah, there's more stuff to collide in with more stuff and then it breaks up. And the thing is, in space, is that this debris is moving so fast. It's faster than a speeding bullet. So you can have flecks of paint that could actually be lethal if they were to hit you. So
that's not great.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of
so in a way,
scary.
I guess it will hinder space travel because if you have this like debris field, it will be hard to penetrate.
Yeah, well, basically, this is a thing that we actually have to deal with at the moment. There are sections of space when we're trying to launch rockets that completely stop us from our being able to get up there in the first place. And so... if this goes on, this is a very serious risk of this happening with the satellites that is being proposed now. Another big issue is that it's not just Elon Musk who wants to do this. There are a lot of other companies that are gearing up to create their own megastructure satellites. And so its space will get very crowded very soon. And also, once a satellite's up there, it's going to, 10 years from now, what is that satellite going to be doing? You know?
Oh, so you mean as it sort of gets outdated?
Yeah, well, everybody who's bought a computer probably hasn't kept the same computer for 10 years. If you have, I'm very impressed. So what do we do with those satellites when they stop working? Do we just leave them up there? Are people going to bring them back down to Earth?
No, but I guess we need to develop better strategies for actually cleaning space. But I've also read that, you know, this also disturbs the discovery of near-Earth asteroids and like asteroid... coming into
Earth. Yeah, so we actually have some quite well-developed technology which tracks comets that could be like what happened to the dinosaurs, right?
We don't want that happening again.
Exactly. And like, you know, worst case scenario, we detect an asteroid and then these satellites mess with the equipment and we make a calculation and we predict that this asteroid won't hit Earth. And then we stop thinking about it. Then all of a sudden, a few months down the road, those satellites' interference meant our math was off, and then it collides, and we could have actually done something. So there's those risks as well.
I mean, I guess mainly, you know, as an astronomer, because I've been observational astronomer, I've been giving this a lot of thought and been actually quite annoyed with how all of this is handled, since it's actually very problematic for how we do observations. Like, one thing, it will actually light up the sky, but they also interfere with the observations.
Right, yeah, exactly.
So that hinders us to do our work. And, you know, we're dealing with very limited observation time. We have to apply for time at the telescopes, and you have to get very lucky to get that time. And what if you sit there in the telescope and, oh, shoot, you can't observe because you have Starlink?
And, like, what a lot of people will argue is that we have started using space telescopes, so the Hubble Space Telescope or James Webb, right? And, like, I think you and I both know that that actually isn't a very good argument because, well, ground-based telescopes can do a lot more than some space telescopes can.
Yeah, of course. And also, like, just looking at the cost, if we can compare, we have the James Webb Space Telescope coming up pretty soon, I think.
Yeah.
Of course, it's going to be a great telescope, but it's like the telescope is like 6 meters,
I think.
And we can compare that to the extremely large telescope being built as well, which has a mirror of 39 meters, and this costs only 10%. We could have like 10 of those ground-based telescopes for the cost of one space telescope.
Right. And then also one other thing that people don't realize is that we need to plug instruments onto these telescopes too.
Yeah, of course. That's what we actually use to, like, analyze the data.
Yeah, exactly. And also to get data as well.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So, like, you and I both work with spectroscopy.
Yeah.
Spectrographs can be quite heavy machines and can get very large very quickly if you want to make them very sensitive. And so the biggest problem is that you can't get that into space because it becomes too heavy and too costly.
Yeah, and you also can't really, well, partly you can't fix it if anything is wrong. Or, well, you can, but it's going to be a lot more cumbersome to fix something in space rather just to, you know, take your car and drive there. And also you can't really update it. You can't develop new tools.
Definitely. It seems a bit. So one of the biggest issues, like, well, is the goal, what Starlink and these other satellites are aiming to do is to bring the internet to the rest of the world, right? Is the idea is that these satellites can beam down and become internet modems for people that are living in rural areas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's good,
I guess, but there's also a few underlying problems with that train of logic is that to access Starlink, you need a modem and a specialized modem to access it, which is expensive. And the problem is that are those people going to be able to afford those? And then, if you're in a politically tenuous situation, is that going to be a problem in getting a hold of those modems? And then if you own those modems, okay, you're going to get in trouble. So there's the idea is that we might be providing this access to the internet, but there are a lot of other elements that haven't been really considered or have to be on to access the internet. You still have these individuals who need to do something who may not be able to.
And also, I have an issue with this. It's that it feels very, like, cowboy-y. It feels like first come, first serve of space. And should space really be like that?
No, exactly. I think that, you know, we shouldn't feel... Well, there aren't a lot of rules that that we've in place internationally that limit people's access to to space. Or just really people are carving up pieces of space for themselves without really much consideration of future generations. And I think you would probably agree with me that we really need to start thinking about doing things sustainably now.
Mm. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
It's way overdue.
It's way overdue, right? Yeah. And I think space is a big thing, right? If we let people do whatever they want with it, it's going to end up leaving to costs and people are going to be left out.
Yeah.
And so the people that benefit from these are going to be a very, you know, special group of people. And then, you know, even though the internet claims to help other people. Yeah.
I really think it's time for, like, the UN or with the help of IAU to step up and make sure that people who litter down space take responsibility.
Definitely. I think there's some kind of individual autonomy to make sure that the space stays clean is important. And I also think that it's on everybody who wants to engage and work with space that they also accept that they have some responsibility.
But also, like, not only for future generations of astronomers like ourselves, but also for like the future of humankind.
Exactly. So, you know, we want our we want the children of the future generations to also be able to enjoy space and not to be resentful of their past generations because they were short-sighted.
No, and I'm thinking like if Elon Musk is so keen on us going to sort of Mars and I know beyond in the solar system, then maybe he should make sure that the track out there is clean.
Yes, I think that too. I think we can't actually go to space if we can't leave Earth. So
no, well, maybe we should sort of calm ourselves a bit before our visitor arrives.
I think that's true. I don't really want to put her through a lot. Right.
Nice to hear what you have to think about this.
Yeah, this was good. And now I'd like to welcome to the mic Joanna Lewis, who works at the European Spallation Source, or the ESS for short.
Hello.
Good morning, Joanna. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
That's good. So tell us a bit about yourself. How'd you end up at the ESS?
So I'm from the UK. Mm-hmm. I arrived in January 2020, and I live here in Lund now. Before that, I was living near Oxford, and I worked at a research council in the UK. And I worked at a site called the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory, which has loads of different big science experiments on site. But it has one, which is a spallation source. And the European spallation source is a similar technology and that's being built here in Lund. So I've been keeping an eye on what's happening here for a number of years and got pretty excited about it. So I was really pleased when I was able to move over to Sweden and have a chance to work here at one being built from scratch.
Yeah. So what exactly is a spallation source?
So it's a good question. Yeah. So spallation, I think of spallation as a little bit like the word splatter. It's when you're trying to splatter a piece of metal to get things out from inside of it. If you can imagine firing something hot and fast enough that it will make metal splatter. What it really means is it's actually a mining term. It means like chipping tiny pieces off a piece of rock. But what the European spallation source is doing is a lot of the machine is actually there to produce these neutrons, which is what's going to come out of our piece of metal, which is tungsten.
Yep.
So when it's all functioning and working, scientists will then use those neutrons, which we get out of the tungsten, in order to do all sorts of experiments in materials research, and looking to enable scientific breakthroughs in energy or health or environment. And so there's lots of different areas of science that are going to be affected by it.
Okay, cool. So what do you do at ESS then?
So my job is what we call public engagement. So talking to the public and schools about what we're doing and what we're planning to do. Mm-hmm. I'm working a lot with teachers. I'm really keen to speak to teachers about how ESS and the kind of science and engineering that we do can help them teach the gritty areas of physics, which are maybe a bit hard to explain or a bit hard to give a real example for. ESS has tons of examples of those. So we accelerate protons very, very fast. That's how we make the neutrons, is we accelerate protons down a vacuum until they hit this tungsten. That's what makes the neutrons come out. But the physics in there is really dense and really exciting. It's going to be one of the most powerful accelerators in the world. A lot of it runs at 2 Kelvin, so that's kind of more than 270 degrees below zero.
Wow, okay.
And it's all working at super speed, almost the speed of light. So there's some really cool physics that happens in the accelerator part just to make the neutrons. And then once we have these neutrons, I say they can be used by scientists from loads of different fields because really what they're for is to just look inside stuff. So if you imagine these neutrons are a bit like light, they are there to look, to be very bright and to look right inside different samples that the scientists might have put inside.
Okay, so you said something about accelerating protons towards the speed of light. The speed of light is, pretty fast.
Yeah.
How do you get something to move that quickly?
So it's a kind of incremental process. So this accelerator is 600 meters long. Some people might have heard of the accelerator in Geneva, of CERN, which has the Large Hadron Collider. That's 27 kilometers long. So they have a very long way to go, and they go round and round in a circle over and over again.
Yeah.
What's interesting at ESS is it's only going 600 meters, and it only does it once. You can't speed up with each revolution like you can with CERN. So it does it in steps. So at the beginning, we use what we call RFQ, this kind of radio frequency use, which speeds up these protons at the beginning quite fast. And that part is well-established way of accelerating things, and they get quite fast quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's cooled with a water-based system. So it's kind of room temperature, which has been used a lot before. When it gets past that part of the accelerator, we want it to go much faster, and it moves into a different phase. And that's where we start using things like superconductors. They allow you to move things without that loss of heat that you get. So you don't need water to cool it anymore.
Right.
But you do need superconductors. And that's what needs to be kept at this really, really cold temperatures.
Right.
So once you've got superconductors, things can move really, really fast because there's no... they're in a vacuum, so there's no air that gets in the way, but also you don't lose too much energy, so they can get faster and faster all through that process. The unusual thing about ESS is that is actually the way that it's being built. Each section or each component of ESS is being built by organizations in different countries. So the people in the world who are the best people at building those particular bits of kit are busy building them right now.
Right.
So the reason it's not online yet is that they're all in different countries of the world, being built and being designed, being carefully tested. And then one by one, they're being delivered over here to Sweden. So at the moment, we have lots of different bits, which will gradually be joined together until such a point as they're all fitting, they're all together. And then we've got our accelerator and then the rest of the machine all ready to go.
It's actually really interesting that you mentioned that. So Mikhail, who was the first person on our episode, made a comment that modern science really is diverting from the work of individuals more towards collaboration-based teamwork.
Exactly.
So we don't really have these Einsteins anymore who are coming up with these amazing theories, but this collaborative, it's where everybody, you know, contributing their own expertise to make something is important. Do you find that inspiring when you see that?
Totally amazing. And that's one of the things that really inspires me about ESS is this concept that we're building something that's so big and so complicated that it couldn't ever be built by one university or even by one country.
Yeah.
Because we don't have the money, but also we don't have the skills and the expertise. And so only by collaborating together can you actually combine the best brains, but also the best technology and the best experiences to build something that all works as one at the end. It's a really amazing way of working. There's more than 50 different nationalities at ESS, but more than 100 different organizations building components. And I find that a really exciting, if slightly complex, jigsaw that we're trying to build.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like a big puzzle. You also talked about, because you're part of the teaching and the outreach programs at the ESS. And I remember when I was in high school, I went to a government school, and we didn't have that much funding. And so we always learn about these accelerators in a textbook and never really see it. How important do you think it is for kids to actually see the science being done before their eyes?
I think what's amazing about places like ESS is that it is quite hard to get a sense of it, of the size of it and of the capacity of it until you actually go there and see it. So most of the building is kind of 40 meters high. The target is inside is hanging from a shaft that's 7 meters, like
wow,
a pendulum inside this kind of vessel, so that it's free spinning inside. The target itself actually rotates. It's like disc that rotates. It's kind of completely phenomenal. So it is quite hard to get a sense of that. On the other hand, it's also quite difficult to visit. So I haven't seen this disc. Well, actually, it's still being built in Spain, but I also can't go inside the target. So a lot of my work actually is trying to create ways that we can help people to see inside without going inside.
Mm.
So we're designing animations to help experience those, but also virtual reality and augmented reality. I think these tools can really help teachers and young people to experience these things that are hard to visualize. If you're looking at the pages of a book, a picture that tells you, this is how the forces react in this situation is all well and good. But actually, if you could have the chance to actually put a headset on and try it yourself and understand which things repel and which things attract, maybe I think it can really help build a much deeper understanding in teachers' minds that can help them teach, and then ultimately in pupils' minds as well. So I think this is the way that we can help more and more young people to actually use, as I say, the science of ESS to help them in their own lessons. Even if visiting itself isn't, there's always a finite number of people who can come to a place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I'm trying to think of ways that actually more people can experience it, even if they can't come on a visit.
Yeah, I think it's actually really important that teachers are both inspired by the science that they teach, but also understand or get a better understanding of the science they teach. Because, you know, I think every high school student has that memory of the tired teacher who just pulls out the textbook and gets exercises. Yeah. And I think it's really inspiring to see that you're really trying to add some creativity to get them to understand it so then they can show, well, how cool the universe is around us and how we're doing some really phenomenal stuff with the science that we do. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then, so hopefully it will inspire them on the, like, the physics side, as I said. But actually, if you are at high school right now, when ESS is finished, if you have decided that science is something you're interested in, you could choose to go to university. And when you finish university, actually, you can be the sort of people who'll be the first users of a place like ESS. So it's really that age, it's your machine. This is the interesting thing about building giant experiments. It's a little bit like building big things that go out into space, because they take many, many decades. So if I used to work with a lot of engineers working on the James Webb Space Telescope. Yep. Some of them had worked on that for 20 years and are still waiting for the science to come out of it. And that's our, you know, that's the next generation's space telescope. This is a similar thing. This is the next generation's microscope. It's the way that high school students who go on to university and study, whether it's life sciences or geology, archaeology, they want to know about how to create vaccines, for example. They're the ones who are going to come and use ESS in the future.
Yeah, I think that is it's important to show them that, because, like, one thing I'm really excited for is the ELT, the Extremely Large Telescope. That'll basically come online when I graduate as a PhD student, or give or take a few years after that. So that's pretty much where my career is going to be, is going to be focused on trying to get time on that telescope to point it at stars and objects that I think are really interesting. And so I think it's almost like a teaser, I guess, of what the possible possibilities are. And so, so you said that students going to university might have a chance to use the ESS. So when exactly do you think it'll come online?
So, I mean, it takes a long time to build a giant machine like this.
Of course,
and the more organizations you have involved, the more complex it becomes. There has been the small issue of a global pandemic that's also taken place.
Yep.
So since the COVID-19 pandemic, a lot of those planned deliveries, you imagine these people all over the world building stuff for us, if they've had their own national lockdowns, some of them haven't been able to carry on building. And actually getting those people to come to Sweden has been very complex with these kind of, you know, issues with travel restrictions. So we're actually at the moment reassessing exactly the timescale. So I can't answer your question exactly.
Sure.
So we're doing quite a comprehensive process trying to work out, well, what does each little seemingly small delay actually, how do they add up, and how will that affect the overall timescale? One thing that we have been able to carry on doing all this time, though, is all of the civil construction. So all of the buildings are still being built all this time. And actually, all of that construction will be finalized by the end of this year. So all the buildings, all the bricks are in place, which is great. And that's all awesome. Gone according to plans. So that's been really cool to watch, even from home, all these buildings going up, and this fantastic shaped roof that we have going on the building on the target station. So that's all finished by the end of the year.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, one of the researchers here gave me a really interesting piece of advice, is that science is like watering a flower. It always takes time. And every time I start up a project, it always takes a lot longer than I expect, because there are factors you don't consider. For me, I love what I do, and it's always fun to sort of just work out the next puzzle. So how do you find the motivation to keep going when, you know, for example, the COVID comes in and then, you know, like this really cool spallation source is now being delayed another year? Yeah.
So for me, that's actually quite cool, because I was really keen that I wanted to start thinking about how ESS can talk to the public and schools about what we're doing before the thing is finished. That I think is a really important step. We can ask the public their views. We can talk to schools about what they want and build it into the process as we're going along. Hmm. So this is a kind of, for me, is like a period of testing things out. So we're trialing small scale versions of an augmented reality app so we can test it with some teachers, so that then actually over the course of the next year or two, we can start rolling that out bigger and wider. And as we have member states of ESS who are all over Europe, actually, by the time ESS is ready, it means that perhaps we could have these teacher activities translated into different languages available online. We're hoping to build it into a MOOC, one of these massive online open courses, which would be available for teachers all over Europe. So it gives, I mean, time is is a very useful part of my job. And if it means that we can have something that's more useful and more effective and more genuinely designed for meeting teachers' needs, and that's ready when ESS is ready, all the better for my job, rather than trying to answer the question about what's that thing that's happening over there after it's already happening.
Definitely. So how many languages do you think your content will be if you have a ballpark figure?
So we've got Sweden, Denmark, and France and Brussels on board at the moment. Okay. So it'll be in those languages to start with. But there are 13 member states of ESS. So we have to get funding for each language that we translate. So we'll see how it goes along. But it would be great to have it available in all of those ultimately. But certainly, English, Swedish, Danish, and French at the beginning.
I really hope you manage to get those in languages. I think that's outreach is one of the really important things. And I think inspiring everyone that maybe have languages that aren't English is really important too. It's sort of... it stops people who, because obviously I'm a native English speaker, so, you know, naturally I got a bit lucky in that regard. But, like, there are people who do struggle to learn English, and since it is the academic language, I think having this as an entryway for them to see how cool the science is makes them more motivated to get into the field that they want to as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think if we're trying to reach teachers, perhaps the teachers who already maybe find physics or particle physics a little bit intimidating or a little bit nerve-wracking to teach the detail of, we certainly want the material for that teacher to be available in a way which is accessible as possible for them.
Definitely.
To help them make their teaching as inspiring as they can. Mm. And if that's about translation, then that's what we'll do to make it work for them. And if what they want is virtual reality apps, then we'll, you know, that's the kind of thing that we'll be developing.
Sure, that sounds great. So what do you think the first big discovery is going to come out of ESS?
So it's a good question. My background is biochemistry, and so I always get quite excited by the life science stuff that we will be doing there. ESS, because it uses neutrons, one of the properties of that is it's particularly good for looking at hydrogen atoms, which is great for life science. So something I really like is kind of proteins and these intricate supercoiled shapes and enzymes doing clever things, especially across these like border crossings that you have at the membrane of cells.
Mm-hmm.
The structure of those enzymes is absolutely critical to how they work. And ESS will be able to look exactly at those structures and understand if a protein is like a necklace of a chain of beads on a long string, the way it works is actually exactly how is that bundled into a bunch. And so you have to work out, often with computers, how would that bundling into a bunch work? What shape would it be once it's all scrunched up into a ball? And ESS will be able to look exactly into that shape, turn it around, twist it around at every angle and see which way round does it go. So that's the sort of thing I'm excited about, is these kind of beautiful images of protein structures. But actually, I think there's other kind of really important things that we're likely to be working on pretty soon. So something, especially areas like energy research. So if you think about lithium ion batteries, so these are your rechargeable batteries. A lot of people think about batteries as being electronics.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they're not. Actually, a battery is a tiny chemistry set, and lithium ions literally move from left to right inside these batteries. And because they're chemistry, ESS is a great way to study those atoms. Where are they moving inside the battery? How can we make them more efficient, more safe, more cheap, whatever it is that we need future batteries to be.
Yeah.
So if we want to be able to have a way of storing the energy more efficiently from, say, offshore wind farms, It's actually about making those batteries better and stronger and more efficient. That is going to be the solution to really upscaling those. So I think that there could be some really interesting science in those sort of areas as well.
Right. Okay. That's just, that's awesome. Yeah, I guess we are moving into this electronic age where we're avoiding, you know, trying to lower the use of fossil fuels and doing things sustainably. So I think that is actually one of the really important things about science. And so I guess it's really good that these kind of instruments that we have are like to open up the doors and allow for that complexity to sort of come in.
Yeah, and it's those sort of tiny margins that make the difference and where you need a really precise instrument to be able to look at those.
Definitely, yeah. So you said that it's hard to let people come in to see the ESS. Will the ESS ever be open to the public, or will you be able to take a tour of something? Will I be able to go and have a look at it? And like,
I really hope so. So yeah. We have had some tours in the past, mm-hmm. Before COVID.
Yep.
At the moment, all visits are off. We do have people coming to site because they need to build things and look at stuff. So there's like what we call business critical visits are still happening, mm-hmm. but we haven't got any availability for any public visits at the moment, which is making me quite sad. Mm. But we will one day. There's, as I say, there's always a finite number of people we can fit. So something that I've been developing over the last year is virtual visits. And we've done quite a lot of those. They've been really popular. The great thing about a virtual visit is that we get one person with a mobile phone inside looking at all of the intricate things and showing it to 60 people who are watching it on their own computer. And we could never have got 60 people inside these areas. So
yeah,
I know we're going to carry on doing virtual tours because I think they have a really great value. And if you're interested in those, you can always get in touch with me to find out how to do a virtual tour. And one day, yes, I do hope to have some more public visits.
I would definitely love to come to visit sometime. I think it sounds, it sounds like a lot of fun. So if you had to make a guess, how many Nobel Prizes do you think the ESS will produce?
This is the ultimate like currency, isn't it?
Yes, of course. Yep.
So, what do I think? ESS, I think we could be eligible in quite a lot of different categories, which is quite an advantage. We should be able to get, so I reckon in the first few years, it would be pretty cool to get one in, you know, in chemistry, one in medicine and one in physics as well. So yeah, I think that would be a pretty good result.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's the dream that all academics seem to have.
And of course, any areas that are scientists coming and doing experiments, they could be in all sorts of different fields. So who knows?
Yeah. It'd be interesting maybe if you actually got the Nobel Prize in literature or something like that, you know, someone.
Yeah, the Peace Prize. I don't know if we're so eligible for those.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, who knows? It seems like a complicated instrument. Joanna, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Meridian. Thank you for coming across.
It's been my pleasure too. Thank you for inviting me.
It's been so much fun.
Looking through our telescopes, we can observe and study the universe we live in. We see open clusters, neutron star mergers, asteroids, and much, much more. Today, we'd like to spend a few minutes taking a closer look at one of the many wonders of the universe. Here to assist us, we have Katrin Roos, the editor of the magazine Popular Astronomy. Welcome!
Thank you, Rebecca.
So tell us, Katrin, what's captured your interest today?
So today it's the object known as Nova Stella that was discovered by Tycho Brahe. He was a Danish astronomer at the time, but he was actually from just around here. So at that point...
So he was Danish...
But he was Swedish.
Okay, it's complicated. Right. Okay, yeah. But you know, it's like 20 kilometers from here, so...
Yeah, exactly.
I think I'd call him Swedish.
Yeah. Let's do that.
So when was this?
So that was the 11th of November, 1572. So at this time of the year. And he discovered it while he was walking... home from a pub, actually.
From a pub? Okay.
Right. Yeah, I know, right? So he was an astronomer and he was very good at studying the sky. And he was actually among the first to make systematic studies of the sky. So when he went back from the pub, and I don't know, other people maybe don't think exactly about those kinds of things, but that's what he was thinking about. And he saw this object that was sort of new to him. And
right.
Yeah.
Right, so okay, so he knew this guy so well that he was like,
yeah,
that's a star that shouldn't be here. Or is it a star? Or
yeah, well, he thought it was a star. So he saw something in the location of the constellation of Cassiopeia, something that looked like a new star.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out, we know now, that it was a supernova. And now we call it SN 1572.
Right, so from the year when...
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's cool. So how bright was it? Like, if he could see it?
Yeah, yeah. So he could see it. It was actually not so weird that he thought about it. Probably other people did as well. So it was approximately as bright as Venus, the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually like the brightest thing we see in the night sky, except for the moon. So it was a bright thing he saw.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and you can often see Venus like in the morning or in the evening when it sets. And yeah, it's actually fairly bright. Okay, well, can you see it today?
No, today there's just like a remnant left. So there is a nebula, like a cloud of gas and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's super faint. So you can only see it with like really, really good professional telescopes.
Right. Okay. I guess for our listeners who don't really or doesn't know so much, like what is a supernova? Could we sort of go into that?
Yeah, so a supernova is sort of the death of a star, if you want. So it's like when a massive star is reaching the end of its normal stellar cycle and it's out of fuel, basically. It collapses and explodes. And then that's when it shines so bright. So it becomes a supernova for a little while. And then you have this remnant nebula left after.
So it sort of just dims down with time.
Yeah, exactly. So you could probably see it for like a year or so after Tycho discovered it, but not anymore after that.
Oh, that's really cool. Well, yeah, thank you, Katrin. This was super interesting.
Thank you, Rebecca. Nice talking to you.
Yeah, look forward to next week.
Yeah.
The fifth episode of the first season of The Meridian was hosted by Rebecca Forsberg and me, Nicholas Borsato. Our guests today were Joanna Lewis and Katrin Rus, and our producer, Anna. If you have any comments or questions about the show, then feel free to reach out to us via our emails or the Lund Observatory account on Twitter. In our theme at the beginning of the show, we could hear the members of the 2021 Astronomic Youth Research School, which was held here in Lund back in July. The music is called Twilight and was composed by Stellar Drone. You can find all our episodes on www.astro.lu.se/themeridian. And make sure you tune to next week's episode when we'll be visited by the researcher Paul McMillan here in Lund Observatory, working with data from the Gaia Space Telescope. Thanks for listening.